Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my occasional interview series where I have the good pleasure of sitting down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the video game industry. Today, my guest to my left is Stig Asmussen. He is the project director on Star Wars Jedi Survivor, your second appearance. You're in the rare two-timer club on Unfiltered. Welcome back.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Thanks for showing the interest in the game, and super excited to be here.
We covered it all February long. IGN First, our little sort of cover story thing, trying to bring back the old school magazine, video game magazine days. And as part of that, I had the pleasure of coming down to visit you and play a bunch of the game. And I'll tell you, so April 28th is our new date. I can't wait to play this because I love the first one and I want to get into the second one, but I guess I'll start here with you because when I was there, a little sort of behind the curtain, the release date was still March, and then it was shortly after where there was a sort of weird phone call. It was like, actually, we're pushing the game back, but we're still going to just, we're going to go ahead with the coverage, which was great, but I'm curious to ask you, the guy that's directing this game, you've got the full oversight on everything. What is it like when you have to go to the bosses and ask for more time on a game with A, an already announced release date, and B, this is a big game. This is a big game for Respawn. This is a big game for EA. This is a big game for EA shareholders. Like, this is, it's a big deal. It is a AAA Star Wars video game. So, like, can you walk me through that process? Like, I have this sort of big dramatic picture in my head, but I'm curious what it's actually like when you have to go and try and get more time on something like this.
I'm not gonna say it's easy. There's a lot of painstaking tracking that we're doing while we're making the game, and we're looking at, when we're supposed to ship, And that begins day one. And as we're getting closer to the finish line, the thing is, with a big game like this, the whole thing kind of comes together at the end. And it's exciting, but it's also terrifying. And it was clear to us that if we wanted to hit, the quality mark that we wanted to hit and get it as bug-free as possible, that more time was needed. Luckily, the conversations weren't that difficult because everybody else, my boss Vince, and all the higher ups within the organization at EA and Lucasfilm as well, they could see the potential in this game. They could see that it was something that people were going to be really excited about, that it was a true evolution of the first game, and we made our case, but it wasn't that tough. I think at the end of the day, it was kind of when we all kind of made the decision, there was a sigh of relief because we wanted to see it as good as it possibly could be, and we wanted the effort that the team put into it for 3 years to be worth something.
Maybe this is an unfair question to put in front of you because I don't, nobody really necessarily has an answer, it's a hypothetical, but do you think that even 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that you would have gotten an easy yes like this? Because for me, as somebody that covers the game industry, I feel like, and I don't mean to call them out in a negative way, but I feel like Cyberpunk, that release was kind of a, kind of turning point's the right word, but I feel like after that, we've seen publishers, the people, that are signing your checks that have to answer to those shareholders, a lot more willing to give a game some extra time. I feel like delays, they've been willing to suffer whatever the short-term shareholder quarterly, you know, loss is to avoid a potential, you know, really bumpy launch. And again, I'm not saying you guys would have had that, but do you feel like that conversation that would have gone, could have gone differently or would have been more difficult even just a few years ago?
I think it really depends on the game. I don't want to speak about other games. I think that if we came to EA with the same situation that we found ourselves in on this game 2 or 3 years ago and they saw the potential, we probably would have gotten the same extension. I think that's, I think it helps that we've got this game as a sequel, and yeah. We've seen like there's a real like genuine excitement about
the
game.
First one sold huge. Let's not.
Yeah, and I think there were really some question marks about how well it would do. But I think you're raising a really good point. I think overall in the industry, yeah, I think that that people are kind of looking at what the consumers and the fans are saying is that they want a quality product.
Yeah.
That's released later rather than something that's, you know, a buggy mess that's released like prematurely.
And pardon me for dwelling on this. I promise we'll talk about more, but
it's a good conversation.
It's just like I don't often get the chance. Like you're in the middle of this right now. Like you're in the middle of your extra time right now. So it's a particularly relevant topic. How do you land on April 28th out of curiosity? Like, because fiscally, and again, this is just my sort of, I guess, call it secondhand understanding of the industry from covering it. I'm not in it like yourself, but you know, you're already into a different quarter.
Right.
So, in a sense,
why
don't you just go to the end of the next quarter and polish more? Like, just I guess if you could kind of help me understand like how you end up landing on April 28th.
So, when we first started having conversations about extending the date, I was asked how much time, and I said 6 weeks. That was exactly April 28th. That's no joke.
That's it.
But we stress tested that date. You know, we looked at what else was coming out around the same time period, and we felt like it was a really good landing spot for us.
Yeah.
So we stuck with it. There was an option, you know, do we want to extend it a little bit longer? But it's like, no, we can get it done. We need 6 weeks.
I mean, I'm honestly kind of surprised that you said you look at other, I mean, I guess, you know, of course you're going to look at what other people are doing, but I feel like you know, I say this with total respect, like I feel like other people have to watch out for your game in this case. You're kind of the heavyweight that everybody else has to go. In fact, like, you know, we don't know it for sure, but because they haven't said, but it sure looks like Dead Island 2 kind of got out of your way because they were already on April 20th and then they went, actually, we can get out a week earlier, which I think is smart of them. So it's interesting to me that you feel like, you know, you've got to worry about other people when you're making a AAA Star Wars game.
Yeah, you never know with other games what's going to be the next lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, true.
And we want to make sure that we've got the clearest runway possible.
So you've made sequels before in your career. I'm curious, what did your years on God of War and the sequels there teach you that benefited you just rolling right into this project from day one?
First thing is it's not always easier making a sequel just because you made the first game. It's you have to control your ambitions because there's a lot of things that, I mean, when we're making the first game, we're essentially building the plane and flying it at the same time, and we had to land it, right?
Yeah.
Now we've got all this groundwork laid out, and everybody on the team's super ambitious, and there's all these big things that we want to do. And I think to a certain extent, that's what the players are expecting as well. So we have to try to manage that. And I learned that working on the God of War series. It's interesting because it was kind of a relearning. It was getting back on the bike again, because when I worked on JFO, I hadn't worked on the first in a series in a long time. It had been probably 15 years.
Wow.
For Survivor, it was like, well, I'm doing it again. I haven't done it in a while. And, you know, God of War 3 shipped in 2010, and here we are now. So.
And when you talk about the building the plane midair, are you, I assume you're kind of talking about everything, like not just the gameplay and like what the game is going to be and how it's going to play, but also technically, like, I had you ever worked, had you ever been on Unreal Engine before?
Never worked on Unreal. I mean, there's a lot of things that we were up against. You know, we started, I was the first person on the team, and we had to build up to a team of, like, I think at the end we were around 155, 160
wow.
people. We had to learn a new engine. We had to come together as a team. Like, most of us had never worked with each other before. And, of course, yeah, we're making a game on a licensed IP that's, like, you know, probably the biggest and most beloved in history. There's a lot of things that we were doing that were first for us. And, you know, super fortunate that we were able to come together and stay steady and see the game through. And you know, the first thing that, like, while we were finishing that game, we were already talking about what we were going to do in the sequel.
When, I mean, I guess you look at the timing and it's pretty obvious that Unreal Engine 5 just, you were too far along,
yeah.
But to even consider that for this game.
Well, we did consider it.
You did. Okay.
I think it was more. I feel like we had the engineering know-how, and I mean we've got some fantastic engineers on our team that could have solved the problem. I think it was more. It was new to Epic at the time, so we did evaluate it, and we came to the conclusion: it's like, let's stick with what we've got right now. And we'll look to, you know, moving to Unreal later in the future.
So when you saw the stuff that Unreal 5 can do, you know, the Nanite and all these cool systems that it's got, like, just kind of built, baked right into it, as a designer, what were your thoughts? Just, you know, knowing that you weren't going to use it, you looked at it, but is it something that's, like, really appealing for the future? Like, wow, I can't, like, this will be awesome when we get a chance to harness it?
Absolutely, but at the same time, though, we were going to a new generation of consoles anyways and new hardware and PCs, so we were looking at ray tracing. That was really exciting.
Yeah.
We were looking at, like, more expansive worlds already with greater detail and fidelity, and just the game was already, like, skyrocketing, like, the technology-wise anyways, so, like, maybe it was better for us that, you know, we didn't make that jump. I mean, I know it was better for us that we didn't make that jump. But if Unreal 5 was in super good shape and it was bulletproof and already devs had already shipped, you know, high quality games on it, maybe that would have been too much for us to achieve in the amount of time that we had.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So you talked about the lessons from making a God of War sequels that you could apply here. What were just generally some of the biggest lessons from Jedi Fallen Order that you pull into this game, either, you know, stuff you didn't like, stuff you liked?
The most important thing was that is just kind of the process on how we make games. And, you know, we did a postmortem after we finished JFO where we got the whole team together and we talked about, hey, this is what's working, this is what's not working. How can we improve our communication, our collaboration? You know, how can we become better as a team?
Yeah.
And the thing is, we never really got to execute on that the way that we had planned because COVID hit, like, literally weeks later, and now we're thrown into this new environment.
Yeah, right at the beginning of the project,
right,
I guess, right? Because you shipped Jedi Fallen Order in November of 2019.
Yeah,
so,
and everybody's getting back from PTO,
yeah.
and you know, COVID hits, and we didn't know how long it was going to last for. I mean, probably heard this story a million times, but it definitely affected and changed what our plans were, and we had to reinvent ourselves,
yeah,
to learn how to work in this environment. And that's something that we're still doing to this day. So lessons learned from a production standpoint, it's something that we're always learning from and always looking for ways to improve. But in regards to, like, building the game, it was all about, we're not going to break what we did before. There's things that people really love about this. There's things that we love about this. So we want to just take what we have done and channel that into new, like, basically what I would call the 2.0 version, the
yeah.
evolved version.
You mentioned that you were, you know, already thinking of ideas, things that you could do for the sequel as Jedi Fallen Order was wrapping up, and we mentioned the sales numbers were enormous. I mean, this game did, Jedi Fallen Order did huge. I'm pretty sure that, you know, whether it's Lucas or whether it's EA, they've got sort of tracking where they they kind of have some decent forecasts of that stuff before it happens. I mean, it's not to say that surprises aren't possible, good or bad, but...
The forecast wasn't that.
It was.
I mean, it was good. I mean, it's a Star Wars game. It's done by Respawn. You know, there was a lot of, like, positive buzz coming out of E3, but it wasn't... We far exceeded what was expected.
So then how, like... How early does the green light happen? Like, are you... Is it before the first game's even done where it's like, yep, we're gonna keep this train rolling?
Yeah, we were already talking about the second game. Frankly, we were talking beyond. And these are conversations that, you know, when we're breaking this story with Lucasfilm, it's like, well, where are we gonna go with the second game? Like, I always wanted to see this as a trilogy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how can we take Cal and the crew to new places beyond what we were doing in the first game? And we had a pretty decent idea of, like, time frame, where we wanted Survivor to take place, kind of like what the stakes were going to be, what the tone of the game was going to be, what Cal was going to be up against, and how the crew was going to factor into that, and you know, there's ideas of what we could do beyond that as well.
So it's probably safe to say that if indeed this series continues, then Unreal 5. It was a much stronger possibility.
I think it's a pretty safe assumption.
Yeah, a pretty safe bet. There'll be plenty of games that have shipped on it by then, and Epic will have their tool set all rock solid. So
yeah, to do something like that, I'm not going to say it's going to be easy. I mean, we have a lot of proprietary things that we've warped the engine into just kind of doing what it does for Jedi right now.
Right.
And we would have to, like, kind of retool some of that to get it to work on any new engine.
I mean, what we've seen as gamers in the community of Unreal 5 so far, either from tech demos or in a couple instances actual games. I mean, it's picturing Cal and friends in a Star Wars universe in Unreal 5 would be pretty sweet. Yeah. So that'll be something we'll look forward to. Kind of on the note, the technology note, how have the new consoles, the PS5, you know, you are not supporting Xbox One, PS4. You are solely in the new generation. So how have these consoles made your lives easier, or even more difficult potentially?
I mean, more difficult. I think the only thing that I would say is that there isn't parity with the controllers. I wish there was. That we're designing a game for a different feeling when it's in your hands. Other than that, you know, like the architecture is pretty similar. We've got the ability to stream things in much faster than we did before with the new SSDs. There's ray tracing capabilities, so we can, we've been talking about in my career doing real-time lighting all the time for 2 decades now.
Yeah.
And I've never been on a project until now that we've actually been able to achieve it. And that's something that's thrilling and exciting. And I think it empowers our lighting team to do things and see results really quickly. That's been a godsend. You know, we're able to be because of the new GPUs and the processors, we're able to make larger worlds than we ever could before. You know, as it stands, this game could not run on last gen consoles just because of the sheer size and the fidelity and the detail that we're putting into everything.
You mentioned the controller stuff. Are you guys doing any DualSense specific stuff?
Yeah, we are, but I'll save the details for that.
Fair enough. We got a little ways to go until launch. So Jedi, this is now, do I have the count correctly, Jedi Survivor is the third game that you've been the game director for?
There was actually one other game I was the director on, but it got canceled.
Okay, so
that was at Sony after God of War 3, and it got canceled. It was unfortunate, but
yeah, I think we talked a little bit about that last time you were in here. Actually,
I believe we did.
So where I'm going with that is, do you ever miss the days of just focusing solely on art? I'm sure there are sort of trade-offs between having the God's eye 10,000 foot view vision over everything and just the head down. I'm gonna make the coolest art and the coolest worlds for this game I possibly can.
You know, if you asked me that 5 years ago, I would say, yeah, definitely, but not anymore.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't think I'd be very good at art anymore. And, but I think I'm pretty good at what I do. And I'm comfortable with what I do, and that's kind of like how I approach each day is you know, this is why I'm here, and this is you know, is if I'm happy doing it, then hopefully I'm doing a good job.
So you've sort of bridged the, you've cleared the valley between the sort of uncertainty and an unfamiliarity of a new job, in a sense, a new role, to now you've got the experience under your belt for it now.
I think my brain is more tuned to taking macro pressure than like kind of like the dialed in, like it's not smaller, it's like if you're working on a key part of the game, there's an immense amount of pressure on that, but it's a different type of pressure.
Yeah.
And my brain is kind of like rewired to work on kind of like more macro pressure.
What is directing a game now, over this is the fourth go around for you with it, what has that taught you about the other non-art disciplines of making a game? You know, since you probably, you know, you were so heads down in the art world before, I'm sort of curious now how your perspective has changed.
So when you're talking about other non-art disciplines, you're talking about like
programming, like, design, et cetera.
I think they're all art. I kind of approach my conversations with any of the departments the same way because of my experience, because we're all creating art together. And but to answer your question in more depth is I've learned a lot about audio. I've learned a lot about animation systems. I've learned a lot about code that I didn't know before. I think I had a pretty, as an environment artist and an art director, and also like as early on in my career as an environment artist, I was also doing level layout and level design as well too. Those tools allowed me to have a pretty broad understanding already of talking to all the different departments.
Yeah.
And you know, understanding their needs and how to collaborate best with them. So I already had a pretty good, just from my experience, like I had a pretty good like groundwork established of like how to like communicate with others. But it's every day I go into a conversation, I go in there with like you know, an open mind and try to listen to like what other people, you know, what their issues are.
Yeah.
And what is their goal, and try to balance that against the other departments. So I don't really weigh any one department heavier than the others, because collectively is where we get our success.
Yeah. In talking to a million developers over the years, it seems like it's always pretty tough to let the game go and actually say, yes, it's finished, here, have it. Is there anything about Jedi Fallen Order that you wish you could go back and change, or is that just what the sequel is for?
You know, in the moment, I don't think that there's... I wish we had a little bit more time with that game, because I think we could have... It shipped with some bugs in it that like we regretted, but we did get it done on time, like we said we were going to. You know, there's things that once it went out in the wild, things like we've added like quick travel to the game. We were staunchly against that in the first game because we wanted it to be kind of like a true Metroidvania,
right,
like kind of approach, and the game was too big for that. And it's when you're so close to it and you can see the game from beginning to end in your head, you lose perspective. But when everybody else is asking for it, it's like, yeah, we probably should have done that. So there's nothing I can like point at and say, man, I wish we got that into the first game. I'm pretty proud of what we did.
I'm not saying you shouldn't have been, by the way.
No, I'm not taking it that way.
Yeah, a lot of developers, it seems like they always feel like there's this one, you know, something that was that they wish they'd left on the table or, you know, had more time to get to. But it's that's got to be almost bittersweet shipping a big game like that, where you're proud of the team getting it out the door, but like, oh, if you could have only done that one other thing.
No, because you always got your next chance.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as you do well, you have your next chance. And I don't feel like it's bittersweet, because when it goes out, I mean, if it's a success, it's not bittersweet, because it goes out and you see everybody enjoying the game and you see the reaction.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Nothing better than that.
You know, is there you mentioned the exceeding, like, by a lot, sales expectations on the first game. I'm going to ask you kind of a personal question here. Do you personally, are you able to enjoy that when it gets to that figure and you know that the original forecast was good, but not that? Like, are you able to personally enjoy that at all?
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about, I never take for granted what we're doing, and the fact that, like, we're making something that is allowing people to enjoy themselves and have fun. And the more people that you can do that you can touch that way is immensely important.
Is there does it buy you anything with the sequel in terms of, like, because I can't imagine that your budget was particularly tight on this game anyway.
Sure.
But does that sort of over and above success kind of, does it help the sequel in any sort of meaningful way?
Yeah, it does. I think that there's on the first game, there's a lot more questioning in regards to, hey, why are you making these decisions? How do these pieces work together? Now people can actually see that. They could see that in action because we shipped the first game, and it was less about, you know, give us regular updates, let us know that you're making progress. But it was no longer about what is this game.
Right. So development cycles seem to be getting longer and longer with each successive generation, and just as the years go by. Your team just turned around Jedi Survivor remotely,
right,
pretty quickly, like relative to what we're seeing from some other fellow AAA games that are 4, 5, 6+ years. And you've jumped console generations as well, like you were talking about. So what do you attribute that to? Like, is that feels almost like it used to be, seemed like at two, you know, you'd expect the sequel in 2 years. Now it's like 4 or 5, and you guys did it in 3 across a new console generation as well.
A little bit more than 3, yeah.
Yeah, what do you attribute
three
that
to? 3 plus 4 months.
It's
a testament to the team more than anything else. The testament to, you know, the fact that we were able to adapt to working remotely, which is not easy, and particularly in regards to communication, and when you're making a game that the departments have to be in lockstep. I mean, it's a minor miracle to a certain extent that we were able to to pull it off. And again, it's I think we've got individuals that really worked together to overcome a lot to get us to where we are right now. I feel really fortunate about that.
I have to imagine that at the beginning, when you're all working from home, what the hell's going on? Don't know how long this is going to be. And then it kind of the reality sets in that it's going to be a while. I would imagine there's a lot of cross team talk within EA, but maybe you're also talking to friends and other developers of like, what tools are you guys like? Is it Slack? What project management tools? Like there's got to be a lot of just sharing of notes and knowledge amongst the development community at large to try and help each other out and get everybody sort of, full speed ahead in this new unforeseen reality.
And we're still learning from it right now as well too. I think one of the things I think EA did a really good job making sure that we were prepared and we were able to, continue working very rapidly once the who knows how long it's gonna take
right.
mode went in. And, that evolved over time. Really within, more than anything, within Respawn, where we have several teams, we're communicating with each other. And, from a leadership standpoint, we are, but then also the devs on each team are talking to each other. Slack was a major tool that we started using right off the bat. And now it's like, it's our primary way probably of communicating.
Us too, here at IGN.
I mean, even more so than Zoom.
Yeah.
You have Slack conversations that lead to Zoom conversations that lead back to Slack, but it's usually always starts and ends with Slack.
Yeah.
We found ways as a team too to kind of, I think one of the biggest things that was missing was just kind of that connection that people had of like seeing each other face to face, not talking about the game, talking about what's going on
yeah.
in the world, talking about, what's the latest show that's on TV or what's the latest other game. And that was lost. And I think a lot of people felt really isolated. And some of the things that we used to do, like every Friday, actually back then, pre-pandemic, once a month we'd get together as a team and we'd do something that we call show and tell. And that's where the whole team would get together in a central area where we had like big TVs and very freeform. People could go up and show their latest work and they had a microphone and they could talk about it. And we'd have like food, we'd have like, drinks, and we'd end the day early and people could, see what everybody else was working on. That was lost.
Yeah.
And we said, hey, why don't we just start doing that again? And we started doing it over Zoom. And it was a huge hit. And I would argue that it's actually better, it's a better format than the way that we did it before. It's more organized, that's for sure. We haven't lost our freestyle kind of personality to it, but I think it's better because it was needed more than it was in the past.
That's a good point.
And we developed another thing too that we call the Jedi conversation, which is a lot of times people just have questions that that they want to bring up, or just have a conversation about how the game is doing. So what we ended up doing is every 2 weeks we do the Jedi conversation, then 2 weeks later we do the show and tell and keep that kind of cadence rolling.
Yeah.
And the Jedi conversation was like beforehand, we'd have a Slido survey that goes out where people could ask questions and we'd make announcements and general announcements if there were any. We still do this, by the way. Last one was last Friday. We would go through all the questions that people asked, and then we would just open it up. Does anybody want to ask questions now? And like, it truly was a conversation like you and I are having right now. It's just that there's like 200 people in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have to imagine, again, even within, you got this done in 3 years entirely. I mean, we've kind of come back to more normal life a little bit here over the last, year or so, but Would I be correct to guess that, because the pandemic slowed basically everybody down, and
yep.
understandably so. So was the original plan to get this game out maybe like last fall, like before the pandemic, like the very beginning when you were initially forecasting, before we knew there was going to be a pandemic.
Over the course of production, we track different dates. We have like our original target. I mean, this was the same thing on JFL. We've got our original target. Then we, like, after, you know, major milestones, we revise that. That's just a standard part of making a game.
Makes sense.
We fell very close to, like, what our original target was.
Super impressive. And then what's, I know every developer is kind of different. It's still evolving. When I was down there, there were some people in the office. What's kind of the mode now? Like, are you hiring people to work anywhere? Are you hiring talent, like, from around the globe? Are you eventually looking to come fully back into office? Kind of where's Respawn at now?
So at the beginning of the pandemic, we thought it was probably like everybody else. We thought this thing's going to blow over in a few months.
Yeah.
And when it didn't, people started asking, rightfully so, people started asking questions. I started asking questions. What are we going to do? This is long term. And the first question is, well, what if people want to move away from the studio? And we allowed that. Second part was, well, if we're allowing people to move away from the studio, why don't we just start hiring people from all over the globe? We did that. Then the next question was, some people want to come back to work now. How are we going to do that? And we started putting together a plan to get people who wanted to come on full time. I think first it was our audio team wanted to come back in full force, hybrid. Then they went to full time. They're full time every day now. And then there's a collection of other people that wanted to, like, just basically pick when they wanted to come in. And we did this, like, we had surveys to gauge what the team's interests were, how they wanted to work. And ultimately, we've decided on it's up to the individual.
That's great. That's the best answer right there. That's so great. So you could look at that as a silver lining in a really unfortunate situation. That sounds like, I mean, your talent, you have, sounds like more talent now, because it's, you know, you've got people that either weren't in the LA area or didn't want to come there.
Yep.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And we've got people that have had the opportunity to leave LA, which is an expensive area, and go to other parts of the country
or
the world.
So I am a player. I will say, I've said this on podcast, I'm not a big Soulsborne player. It's just not generally my genre. But to me, I think JFO is arguably the most approachable Soulsborne game that's been made yet. First of all, I guess, would you agree with that assessment that it does sort of fit that subgenre of sorts?
It's certainly, from a combat standpoint, it is definitely an inspiration for us and a touchstone when we were making the original game. But we also wanted to have kind of a Metroidvania, which Souls does as well too.
Yeah.
Very loosely, Metroidvania approach. But we wanted it to be an action platformer as well too. So there definitely are Souls roots in it, but there's roots to, like, a whole host of other games. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a mix of different ingredients.
Well, on that note, the Miyazaki, the showing everybody the genre that he arguably created and is the best at. Did you play any Elden Ring last year?
I think I've got about, unless I checked, like 120 hours or something like that. I'm at the very end of the game, and I, in the last section of the game, that I think it's the Ash City, and I stopped playing it because it's I did the same thing with the TV series Battlestar Galactica. I never watched the last episode.
Interesting.
Because I don't want it to end. And I'm doing the same thing with Elden Ring. So if that speaks at all about how much I like the game, I was able to beat, is it Melania? Probably the hardest boss ever. And what I love about that game is, like, I could cheat. I could go and shoot a chicken for hours, or I could hand my kid the controller and say, hey, shoot this chicken for a while. And then I could come back and I'm powerful now. It's got this adaptive way of, like, leveling up your characters. It's brilliant.
Did you do you take any notes from an Elden Ring for the future, where you're like, oh, this something like this could work well in what we're doing down the road?
I'm always taking notes. I don't think there's anything that really stands out other than, like, just I think the atmosphere in the game was brilliant. And it was so compelling to come back to, because it's one of those games when you put it down, you know, an hour later, you're already thinking about, these are the things, this is the checklist of things that I'm going to do when I come back to the game.
Yeah.
And it's like going, the game is working overtime inside your head. And to achieve that is really something special. Not a whole lot of games are able to do that.
Diablo 4 is that for me. I know exactly what you're talking about. What was priority one heading into Jedi Survivor? Like, where you just start, you're starting the project. This is the thing we need to do above all else.
Like I said, the first priority is that we're not going to, you know, break what we had. And everybody understood that, believed in it. We came up with a guiding light very early that said, you know, this is how we're going to evolve combat. This is how we're going to evolve our pillars. Combat, our traversal, our exploration, and our narrative. We also added a new pillar, which is customization. That's something that we had in the last game. We added very, very late because, again, when I said earlier, the game comes together late. You're playing it. What's missing? What do we need to add? And we realized it's like, we don't have anything for the player to get in this game. What do we do? We can do ponchos.
You can rock new hair for Cal in this one.
Yeah. So in this one, it's like, all right, the thing that we really felt we landed well on the first game in terms of rewarding the player was the lightsaber pieces.
Yeah.
That was a real value customization part in the game. And we said, let's give the lightsaber treatment to everything. You know, the way Cal looks, the way BD looks, the lightsaber, we got a blaster in the game. So just many more ways for the players to kind of mix and match the appearance and customize it for how they want the player and the experience to be.
Are you a Disneyland guy?
No.
Not really? So I was going to ask you if...
I don't like lines. I like Disneyland, yeah. But I hate lines.
I was going to ask if it was a head trip for you that you can build Cal, you can get Cal's lightsaber.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's incredible.
Disneyland.
That's amazing.
It's so cool.
We got to go to Disneyland for a preview event at the end of JFO. You might have been there.
I was there, yeah.
Yeah. And nobody was there. We had the park to ourselves. And that was that's amazing Disneyland experience because... No lines. So, but yeah, you can't take that for granted. The fact that we've got, you know, Lego BD, we've got, you know, Cal's lightsaber. There's so many things that we've been in the television shows. There's so many things that, like, opportunities that Lucasfilm has kind of, like, looked for this game and you know, helped it become relevant outside of the game. That I'm
hey, you're canon now, man.
Yeah, I mean, apparently.
Before I let you go here, what are your favorite Star Wars games, past or present?
X-Wing versus TIE Fighter.
Nice.
Knights of the Old Republic. There's this other one. It's called Jedi Fallen Order.
I've heard of it. Yeah, it's not bad. It's all right. KOTOR for me, that game... See, this is why, like, I'm glad Lucasfilm has kind of gotten back to this. They've come full circle where, you know, they did everything in-house for so many years and nobody outside of the building would make Star Wars games. And sure, we got some, there was a great run of, you know, Dark Forces and you're talking about X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. But, you know, then they were smart enough to let, like, Raven Software make Jedi Knight 2 and let BioWare make Knights of the Old Republic. And now... But then it kind of all went away again, but now we're back. Now they're smart enough to let people like you at Respawn make Star Wars games. And they've got, there's a few other ones out there too from some other external people. Which of those other ones that are coming up have your eye? There's Quantic Dreams game, Eclipse. There's whatever this like single player thing Massive's doing.
We've got one too.
Yeah. Peter Hirschman's.
Yeah.
First person
Which,
shooter,
I mean,
right?
I definitely got my eye on that.
Yeah. That I guess you've seen. Certainly.
I think out of those, I mean, they all sound very appealing. I think I would probably, I'm really interested in seeing like a true open world Star Wars experience. So like really excited to see what Ubisoft's doing.
Yeah. It's weird to think I don't think that's ever been done with a Star Wars game before. Like a full blown.
Yeah.
Open world, like let's go.
And people have been asking for it for decades.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally. I think we're done. I think we did it.
Sweet.
Now all that's left is for you to go home and finish the game.
Go back and work on the game.
Yep. April 28th, for sure this time.
For sure.
We're going to do
guaranteed.
It. It is so, Stig, it's so great to see you. Thanks for coming up here.
Thanks for having me again, Ryan.
Yeah, Stig Asmussen, the game director on Star Wars Jedi Survivor. It is out on Xbox Series, PS5, and PC on April 28th. Other games are already scooting out of your way. That's just how it goes. We're looking forward to playing it. For more from the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry, check out all the other, I think, 60-something episodes of IGN Unfiltered. We'll see you next time.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. Wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.